Kane stopped and held up his fist at the sound of the commotion in the distance. He turned and looked at Grant when he heard the rage-filled roar.
I don't like the sound of that.
Me either. How far do you figure?
About 200 yards, give or take. That's where Shizuka's supposed to be, isn't it?
Yeah.
Grant's eyes suddenly narrowed, and he jerked up the copperhead. From the look in his eyes, Kane knew that something was right behind him, and he lunged forward around Grant. As Kane moved, Grant's finger curled around the trigger of the copperhead and squeezed. A jackhammering burst tore from the barrel of the rifle and slammed into the monstrously malformed head of the beast that had appeared out of the murk behind Kane. Diving forward, Kane hit the ground and rolled onto his side as he brought up his Sin Eater. He hesitated for a split second when he caught sight of the creature Grant fired upon. It was without a doubt one of the most hideous things he had ever had the misfortune of laying eyes on, but he recognized it from pics he had seen. The bear beast lowered its bone-shielded skull in an instinctive attempt to protect its vital organs from the barrage of fire, but to little avail. The twin streams of lead tore through the tough flesh, dense muscle, and heavy bone, drilling deep into the creature's body. A lucky round penetrated one of its eyes, before finally stopping in the thick cranial bone at the back of its head, having destroyed the creature's brain on the way. Seconds ticked by as Kane and Grant stood before the beast, watching its tail twitch in post-mortem spasms.
That's what was chasing the tongue? No wonder they were so scared.
Grant ejected the spent magazine from his copperhead and toggled a fresh one home.
What the hell is it? Some kind of mutie?
Not on this island. It's called a dinocephalian. That means terrible head. It's from the Permian Age. Fossils were found in Russia, as well as North and South America.
How do you know that?
When Bridget and Lockhedge found a computer record of all the time periods the temporal dilator had been focused on before Sindri took control of it, I did some research on the kinds of animals that might have been trawled here.
Uh-huh. Let's find Shizuka and join up with the other tigers. If there are any more of these terrible heads around here, we better hook up for safety. I just hope that the Tong are having as much fun as we are.
I can't imagine why they wouldn't be.
When Shizuka heard the stuttering reports from a copperhead, followed almost instantly by the thunder of a Sin Eater, she was off and running in the direction of the fusillade immediately, knowing Grant and Kane had met the murderous bear beast. She had heard its bellows of pain and anger, and then nothing. Movement in the corner of her eye caused the samurai captain to skid to a halt. Swiftly, she brought up her katana. Her blood froze in her veins as another of the bone-headed beasts seemed to appear out of nowhere, only a scant handful of yards from her. Its head was turned toward the sound of the gunfire and the death cries of the other creature, either its mate, sibling, or parent. The creature snarled and lumbered off in the direction of the cacophony, totally ignoring the Japanese woman. She ran her sleeve across her forehead, wiping away the film of sweat. Kane and Grant would need her assistance, so she fell into step after the creature, making sure that she was far enough behind that it wouldn't notice her presence. After only a score of yards, she saw that the creature had stopped and stood on its hind legs, the misshapen head sniffing the air around it as its tiny, bone-encrusted eyes stared off into the darkness. Turning to the right, it growled as it dropped to all fours. Shizuka remained motionless, watching as the monster lumbered off. She sensed an approaching person, and she molded her body against one of the numerous trees that surrounded her. Lowering her arm, she dropped the point of her sword to the ground, in the off chance that whoever was approaching might be Grant or Kane or one of her own samurai. Two more Tong pirates slipped through the undergrowth, looking around alertly and fearfully. Like the others, they were young men, dressed in linen jerkins. The expressions on their dirty, sweaty faces were those of stark fear. The two pirates passed by her position, and she raised her sword, resting the hilt and half the blade along her left forearm. Shizuka counted 10 beats of her heart before she glided away from the tree and crept up behind the Tong. Staying low, she moved with the speed and stealth of a stalking tiger, her prey totally unaware of her presence. Shizuka leaped into the air, kicking out with her right foot, connecting solidly between the shoulder blades of the pirate slightly in the lead.
Oof!
At the same time, she slashed down with the katana, the razor-keen edge of the blade dragging across the front of the other man's neck. She felt it grate against his vertebrae. The pirate she kicked staggered forward, all the air driven from his lungs. The man whose throat she had just sliced wide open reached up with both hands to try to staunch the flow of blood. The man with the cut throat writhed on the ground, mouth working, eyes rolling. His companion managed to grab a sapling and keep from falling. He spun, and his eyes flickered with fear at the sight of the blood-stained blade. Then he realized he faced a woman, and the fear on his face was replaced by a deep anger. Shizuka knew that as far as the pirate was concerned, a woman with a sword was still only a woman. The pirate stepped toward her, holding his hatchet out before him, waving it to and fro. The Japanese woman feinted with her katana, deliberately letting the tip of the weapon fan empty air a good foot from the man's stomach. The Tong reflexively brought his own weapon down swiftly in an attempt to block. Shizuka smiled mockingly and backed away.
Not much of a challenge!
Yeah!
He raised his arm to slash down with the axe with all his might, seeking to split her skull. Anticipating the move, Shizuka gracefully dodged out of the way and slashed upward with her own weapon, deeply cutting the man's fingers on the hand that held the axe handle. The weapon dropped from his slashed fingers, two of the digits falling free amid squirtings of blood. Smiling coldly, Shizuka ducked under his flailing arms and slashed out with the blade, cutting a long, deep gash across the man's chest. When he tried to bring up his good arm to block, she slashed it from elbow to wrist, slicing the flesh to the bone. He backpedaled from the whirling, mirror-bright blade. Shizuka pressed on, letting months of frustration and anger out in one vicious attack. She hated all the Tong, since they preyed on the weak and helpless. She had every intention of making an example out of this particular man. Her sword blade moved blindingly fast, cutting and slicing the hapless pirate until his body was a bleeding patchwork of shallow gashes and slashes. The pain from the wounds forced the man to his knees. He held his hands up before him, tears cutting runnels through the blood on his cheeks.
Please! Stop cutting me! Just kill me!
Shizuka poised herself to deliver a decapitating stroke. Before she could move, a huge paw reached out from between a pair of trees and latched onto the man's head. The force the paw exerted was so tremendous that it caused the man's skull to implode as his body was dragged back into the brush. Shizuka moved quickly backward, then felt her body connect against something hard and unyielding. She tried to whirl around, bringing the katana up to slash at the attacker, when a heavy hand wrapped around her wrist, stopping the attack dead.
Easy, sweetheart.
Kaibutsu! Monster! There!
We know. We saw it.
Kane appeared a moment later, breathing heavily in the night air.
You okay?
Yes. What is that thing?
Kane calls it a dinocephalian.
A what?
It, means terrible head.
Here, take my copperhead. You'd be better off with that than your swords, believe me. It's got a full clip, so just point and shoot.
Shizuka didn't argue with him, despite the samurai code, which scorned firearms. Resheathing her katana, she gripped the weapon tightly, bracing the butt against her hip.
I hear something.
Immediately following her announcement, six Tong raiders burst through the brush, armed with an eclectic variety of weapons, including a couple of rusty pistols. One even had a crude crossbow cradled in his arms. Upon seeing Grant, Kane, and Shizuka, they rocked to clumsy, thrashing halts. Four of the Tigers of Heaven appeared next, brandishing their own bladed weapons, clearly excited at catching the interlopers who had eluded them for so long. It was at that exact moment the dinocephalian decided to join the melee. Bursting out from the screen of underbrush, with the arm of the pirate dangling from its jaws, the prehistoric beast slurped the torn limb into its gullet and bounded toward the group of Tong pirates. Screaming in fear, they turned and ran, right into the waiting swords of the samurai. Shizuka held the copperhead low and fired from the hip, the round smashing into the hind legs of the dinocephalian, but to little effect. It bellowed in pain as it scrabbled around to face her. Acting in tandem, Kane and Grant lifted their sin-eaters and aimed at the head of the creature. Kane's finger touched the trigger stud, and the weapon stuttered with a short burst that chopped splinters out of the sproutings of bone on the creature's head. The rounds fired by Grant smashed into the dinocephalian's upper left shoulder and torso. The wounds were unsightly, but it didn't hamper the creature's movements. If anything, the pain just made it angrier. The samurai were engaged in a vicious hatchet-to-sword battle with the pirates. One particularly large tiger, almost as wide as he was tall, faced off against the Tong raider wielding the cobbled-together crossbow. The samurai raised his katana over his head to strike. At the same time, the pirate shouldered his crossbow and thumbed the trigger switch. The metal-tipped bolt ripped the bloody furrow across the back of the samurai's hand. He grunted in pain, his fingers opened, and the sword fell to the ground. In the same smooth movement, the Tong pirate dropped the crossbow and drew a hatchet from his sash. As he whipped the double-bladed weapon out, the large samurai backed off and drew his shorter Tonto sword with his left hand. He whirled the blade in a glittering arc around his head as he shifted position, standing so his right side faced the pirate. Bending his knees slightly, he spun the sword in a downward half-clockwise circle so the flat blade rested under his armpit. The samurai held his injured right hand out toward the raider, palm up. Then he gave the man the finger. The Tong pirate blinked in surprise. Then his lips peeled back over his teeth in a silent snarl. He brought the hatchet down in a long, arching curve toward the crown of the samurai's head. The Tiger of Heaven seemed to lean backward less than an inch, but the axe missed its target. Almost negligently, the samurai slid his tanto from between his arm and body and used the tip to swat the hatchet out of the Tong's hand, taking a good chunk of the man's thumb with it. The pirate instinctively clasped his hand against his chest, and the tiger followed through, driving the sword through the stomach of his opponent, impaling the man and pinning him against the tree just behind him. The samurai's victory was short-lived. Smelling the blood, the enraged Dinocephalian swiveled about and caught sight of the tiger withdrawing his tanto from the body of the raider. The long, dagger-like claws slashed across the samurai's back, tearing away the armor, rending the flesh beneath and severing his spine as if it were made of rotted twine. The Tiger of Heaven then tumbled face forward into the brush and lay motionless. Grant fired his Sin Eater again, holding down the trigger stud. The prolonged burst drilled straight through the creature's huge paw, smashing away clots of tissue and talons. The Dinocephalian bellowed in agony. Shizuka's copperhead hammered as she fired a long burst at the rampaging prehistoric creature. Blood erupted from the wounds perforating the animal's right side. But with only a 15-round magazine, the subgun could be fired dry in a couple of seconds, and Shizuka did so. Eyes flashing with fear, she thumbed the magazine release and looked over at Grant for another.
Grant!
The Dinocephalian took a stumbling step toward her. Seeing the woman in mortal danger, Grant threw himself between Shizuka and the creature. The beast swiped at him with his good paw. The claws tore four horizontal rents in Grant's shirt, inflicting shallow cuts on his chest. Biting back a cry of pain, Grant took the first action that occurred to him. He grabbed two of the protuberances of bone extending from the creature's jaw and used them to vault onto its back. The Dinocephalian reared, bucked, kicked out with its massive hind legs. Grant managed to wrap his arm around the beast's squat neck as it bellowed in frustration. It violently shook itself, trying to dislodge the human astride its back. The sight of the mad struggle caused the combat between the Tigers of Heaven and the surviving pirates to cease as they stared with open-mouthed amazement. It required all of Grant's considerable strength to hold on as the Dinocephalian tried to shake him loose. He tightened his arms around the neck of the creature and dug his knees into its back, pushing out with them to add even more leverage to his attack. With a gasping grunt of exertion, the animal rose onto its hind legs and tottered madly about the clearing. Shizuka dropped the empty copperhead and drew her katana. She swiftly slid into position and lashed out with the blade at the most vulnerable area within reach, the creature's oversized testicles. One swift corkscrewing stroke removed them from the juncture of the prehistoric animal's legs. Trailing a little stream of blood, they flopped wetly into a bed of crushed ferns. The creature stopped in its tracks. It stood motionless for several long seconds. Then it began to shake all over so violently that it actually managed to dislodge Grant from its back. Stepping up beside Shizuka, Kane fired a single 9mm round into the beast's wide-open mouth. The shot blew a fist-sized chunk of flesh and bone from the Dinocephalian's upper jaw. The second shot drilled straight through the roof of the creature's mouth. The beast toppled backward, narrowly missing Grant as it crashed to the ground. It shuddered once, then breathed out a long, rattling exhalation. The death of the creature broke the stunned spell that had overcome all of the combatants. They once again engaged one another with murderous fury. The fight was over before Kane, Grant, and Shizuka could rejoin it. Within seconds, the last two Tong raiders writhed on the ground, their lifeblood seeping from numerous wounds, soaking into the earth beneath them.
And that, as they say, is that.
The Tigers of Heaven stood there silently, staring at Grant for several long, silent seconds.
What are you looking at?
Grant, that was either the bravest or the stupidest thing I ever hoped to see you try.
Something had to be done.
Shizuka returned her katana to its scabbard, then stood on her tiptoes and kissed Grant's chin.
Arigato, kawaii hito.
Repressing his smile, Kane turned away. Because of his presence and that of the samurai, Shizuka's display of gratitude was very restrained, almost formal. But he could tell by the glint in her dark eyes, she intended to thank Grant very thoroughly and far more informally as soon as they were alone back on New Edo. The tigers busied themselves searching the Tongs. Kane wasn't eager to join them as they plundered the dead.
Somebody ought to call the samurai I left guarding the Tongs' boat and let them know to come in.
Shizuka nodded and produced a black square of pressed plastic from beneath her breastplate. It was a smaller version of the transcoms used by the Cerberus personnel. As she made the call to the absent samurai, Grant gestured to the Tong corpses.
What are we going to do about the bodies?
Let Hikazuchi Kojima deal with them.
Neither Grant nor Kane felt like arguing with him. Hikazuchi Kojima, Thunder Isle, sometimes seemed like one hungry mouth and empty belly. Within an hour, all of the corpses, the dinocephalians included, would be divided up among a variety of digestive tracts.
Kane, I'm going back to New Edo for the night. You figure you can make your way back to the cube without ending up as a meal?
The Cerberus personnel called the main building of the Operation Kronos installation the Cube because it resembled a square mountain of black stone. It held within it a Mattrans gateway.
Nothing's gotten me yet.
It only takes once, or so I'm told. Be careful, Kane-san.
Kane nodded in acknowledgement and set off through the jungle. He realized the visit to Thunder Isle hadn't gone according to plan, but that wasn't particularly unusual. A humming mosquito lit on his face, and he impatiently brushed it off. He experienced a slight sensation of surprise that Grant and Shizuka were still determined to spend a couple of days together a month, despite their respective duties that kept them apart most of the time. Until recently, it had been Grant's intent to leave Cerberus altogether and live in the little island monarchy of New Edo with Shizuka, particularly after the arrival of the Menetius-based personnel and the hybrid woman Quivel. But after being captured and tortured by the sadistic Baron Beausoleil, Grant realized the struggle remained essentially the same. They were just new players on the field. The war itself would go on and would never end unless he took an active hand in it, regardless of his love for Shizuka. Well, Kane reflected, let them enjoy each other while and when they could. God knew both of them had earned a little happiness, the hardest way possible. Kane's own recollections of romance were few and far between. He remembered the few hours spent with the Celtic priestess Fand, or the kiss stolen from Bridget during the time travel trip back to New Year's Eve 2000. But more often than not, the image of Quivel would insinuate itself into his mind, her fall of silken white blonde hair, the perfect frame for the inhuman loveliness of her face. The details of the days in her company during his captivity at Area 51 were locked away in some secret part of his mind, pushed far back into the rear of a mental vault. The vegetation and foliage dropped away suddenly as if the jungle dared not cross an invisible boundary. Before Kane stretched a flat, sandy plain at least half a mile across. Rising from the center of the dead zone was the dark mass of the Cube. It resembled a fortress, but one with streamlined architecture. It loomed above a complex of smaller structures like a squared-off mountain peak. As always, the dark, windowless edifice awakened a quiver of dread within Kane. As he approached the defoliated zone, he stepped onto a marshy patch and sank ankle-deep into foul-smelling sludge.
Aw, fuck. You're not out of the woods yet, Kane.
Reba Dufour, the de facto physician of Cerberus, strode down the lengthy main corridor of the redoubt. Built more than 200 years earlier, the Cerberus complex had been constructed to last close to forever as part of the totality concept's over Project Whisper. It had been designed to be the home of at least 100 people, and for the first time in nearly two centuries, the actual population was nearing that number. What occupied Dufour's thoughts now was a potential new resident, a newborn one. Dufour's stride held purpose, and she knew exactly to whom she needed to talk about the situation that had developed since the arrival of the pregnant Quivel nearly 4 months before. When she reached her destination, she stopped before the closed door and lightly rapped on its surface.
Come in.
Rows of drafting tables with T-squares hanging from them lined one wall. Only a few lights were on, but she saw two figures in the room. One was Bridget Baptiste, sitting at a long, low trestle table at the far end of the room. A gooseneck lamp struck flame-colored highlights from her mane of red-gold hair. Soft music filtered from a CD player. Walking across the room, Dufour saw Bridget crouched over a laptop, her gaze fixed on the information scrolling swiftly across the screen. Resting atop the table next to the computer was an object that resembled a very squat, broad-based pyramid made of smooth, dully gleaming metal. Two of the sides were missing, and revealed a confusing mass of circuitry and microprocessors within. Barely 1 foot in width, the device didn't exceed 12 inches in height. The second figure was Brewster Filboid, an emigre from the moon colony, who probed and prodded the interior with a tool not much thicker than a blade of grass. An astrophysicist in his mid-40s, he was a little over 6 feet, long-limbed and lanky of build. Pale blonde hair was swept back from a receding hairline. He wore black-rimmed eyeglasses, and his cheeks appeared to be pitted with the sort of scars associated with chronic teenage acne. He glanced up when DeFore came to Bridget's side, his expression flickering with annoyance.
What is it now?
Now? You two are in the exact same positions as the last time I looked.
That was when you asked if we wanted to go to lunch.
Exactly. And it's now way past dinner. If you leave now, you might just get in under the wire for a midnight snack.
Bridget lifted her gaze, emerald eyes blinking perplexedly behind the rectangular lenses of her wire-rimmed glasses. Her fair complexion was lightly dusted with freckles across her nose and cheeks. A high forehead gave the impression of a probing intellect, whereas her wide mouth, with the full underlip, hinted at a sensual nature. Her mane of red-gold hair fell in loose waves down her back. Her tight-fitting white bodysuit, identical to DeFore's and Filboid's, showed off her figure to full advantage. The corners of her lips quirked in a slightly abashed smile.
Putting back together what Danann technology tore asunder is proving more time-consuming than I thought.
Putting back together? Isn't this a completely new interfacer?
Pretty much, except for cannibalizing some parts left over from the prototype that Lakesh cobbled together and never used in either the first or second versions.
Is building another interfacer that important? I mean, how often will we have to teleport to two different places at once?
Bridget stood up from the stool and stretched her willowy body, working out the kinks that had settled in her lower back during her long hours at the work table.
We don't need two of them right now, but it certainly couldn't hurt. But we could use a break. Brewster, would you mind checking in the galley and seeing what you can scrounge up for a late dinner?
Sure thing. I didn't know I was so hungry until food was mentioned.
I didn't think Brewster believed the interfacer even worked. What did he say it reminded him of?
An incense burner from a 60s head shop. What's up?
I've been studying what we know about the hybrids ever since Quavel arrived. Since she's now part of our little family, I figured it would be best if I knew what to do if she ever became sick or injured.
I see. And what's the conclusion you've reached?
Conclusions, plural. We know that the Barons need annual treatments to replace their tainted blood to strengthen their autoimmune systems, and that they require an infusion of fresh genetic material or they sicken and die. I've asked Quavel if she'll require the same kind of treatments, and she's been evasive.
And you've come to the conclusion that we don't have the medical equipment necessary to perform the procedures of replacement and infusion if she needs it?
Exactly. The equipment brought down from the moon base helps to synthesize the nutrients she needs, but since the DNA specimen I took from her fetus defies every identifiable pattern, the other conclusion I've reached is that she's carrying a totally new form of Homo sapiens. If her gestation period is anything like that of a human female's, then she should be reaching the end of her third trimester.
Which means that when the delivery time comes, you'll want all the help you can find, even if that means combing every redoubt connected to the Cerberus network to procure any and all medical equipment.
I wouldn't go that far. I could think of only two places where the equipment we need could be found.
And since the Dulce facility is destroyed, that leaves only Area 51.
Unless there's another place we don't know about.
Lord Strongbow had the equipment to concoct the mutagenic virus that created his Imperial Dragoons.
But that would mean a trip to England. Since Kane and Grant helped overthrow the Imperium, I'm sure the Celts wouldn't be adverse to letting us take any equipment that might still be intact.
You know, I believe there might be a place closer to home. Remember when we checked out the various redoubts we thought could have the facilities necessary for the Barons to receive their treatments?
Yeah. The end result is that we have Quavel here.
I recall reading about a small facility located in the Guadalupe Desert that was attached to Overproject Excalibur.
Overproject Excalibur was one of the many branches of the Totality concept, the final phase of a millennia-long conspiracy that led to the Skydark and the eventual enslavement of humanity to the Barons. Over Project Excalibur dealt with genetic engineering, and one of its subdivisions, Mission Invictus, was devoted to altering human beings so they could survive and thrive in the post-Holocaust environment.
No one was sent to inspect the installation, right? Lakesh claimed that it was too small for the needs of the Barons and the Hybrids. Too small for the baronial oligarchy, but not too small for a single hybrid? Maybe not. I'll talk to Kane and Grant about a scouting mission. Shouldn't we discuss it with Lakesh? Not right at the moment. I want to talk to Kane before we go any further. Okay, just let me know. Since it also involves Quavel, I believe that she should be in on the mission as well. Good thinking. After all, she was a technician at the Dulce facility and would recognize the equipment needed. Although I don't know how safe making a Mattrans jump would be for the baby. Since she's the first hybrid ever to be impregnated by a human, there are too many variables to take into account. I'd hate to endanger her baby in the process of trying to help it.
Very true.
Even though her expression and tone didn't reflect it, she felt a little jealous. Over 2 years before, on a mission beneath the Black Gobi Desert in Mongolia, she had been exposed to a strange radiation and suffered chromosomal damage. She had been rendered barren.
I can say this. Quavel appears to be perfectly healthy, and all signs point to this being a normal pregnancy. But I'm not sure I would want her going on this trip, unless we can figure out an easy way for her to make it. I'll talk to Kane tonight. He gated back from Thunder Isle about an hour ago. He popped in to let me know everybody was all right. He's in the armory now. Okay, let me know what he has to say on the matter. We'll talk later.
For a few minutes, Bridget stood there, staring at, but not really seeing, the interphaser. She couldn't deny she had been hurt when Kane finally opened up about what he had been forced to endure during the 2 weeks that Baron Cobalt held him captive in Area 51. It was a mutual pain, as she could sense his anger and humiliation as he related the details of his imprisonment. But now, the pain was closer to home, since the baby Quavel was carrying might indeed be Kane's. She swallowed a curse and strode across the workroom and into the adjacent Cerberus armory. She knew that Kane was inside the big room, stripping and cleaning his Sin Eater, as was his habit after returning from an op. Her long-legged gait swiftly took her to the entrance and into the huge storeroom. Everywhere she looked, she saw wood and metal boxes, filled to the brim with firearms, ammunition, and various other instruments of death. There were enough weapons stored in the room to supply a medium-sized army. Kane sat on a long metal crate stamped with the logo Property of the U.S. Army. His arm was outstretched, and he was flexing the tendons in his wrist. The Sin Eater sprang from its holster and slapped snugly into his waiting hand, then withdrew as he relaxed. Behind him, like a pair of silent sentries, stood two suits of black, form-fitting polycarbonate armor on steel frameworks. The armor belonged to Kane and Grant, reminders of the time when they were the epitome of what it meant to be magistrates. Looking up, Kane nodded curtly to Bridget.
Baptiste, you and Brewster done rebuilding the interphaser?
Not quite. I'm still a little surprised Lakesh is allowing us to upgrade his original design.
He's a changed man, in more ways than one.
So are you.
Prove it.
That's one reason I'm here.
What's on your mind?
There may be a problem with Quavel.
If she hadn't been watching for it, Bridget would have missed the flicker of unease in Kane's eyes at the mention of the hybrid woman's name. He placed the holstered Sin Eater on the metal box next to him and rubbed his hands on the thighs of his pants, wiping off the residue of gun oil.
Isn't there always some kind of problem with Quavel? What is it now?
She very well may need autoimmune boosting treatments prior to her delivery date to ensure the baby is born alive and healthy.
And?
And we don't have the equipment needed here in the redoubt.
Pursing his lips, Kane stared at his hands before he stood up and slung the holstered Sin Eater over his shoulder.
What about all the stuff brought down from the moon base?
That helped synthesize the kind of food she needs, but Reba is worried that there could be complications during the birth if she's not at optimum health, or whatever passes for it with a hybrid.
Where do you propose we find this equipment? Hybridtopia?
Not necessarily. There's a medical redoubt located in the Guadalupe Desert. It's totality concept related, so it has a gateway. I think it might have the equipment needed for gene therapy, but we'll have to make a recon first.
Where's the Guadalupe Desert? Mexico?
California, actually. About 150 miles north of what used to be Los Angeles. Just inland of the coast.
In the Barrens?
I suppose the area is still called that. It falls within the outlying territory of Barren Snakefish's jurisdiction.
Any idea of what we could expect to find out there besides a redoubt?
Sources mention a city named Aten fairly close to it.
Aten? What kind of name is that?
Egyptian. Aten was the ancient Egyptian sun god. His worship was advanced by a post-Nukkost pharaoh calling himself Akhenaten, who had modeled the modern city of Aten on Heliopolis, forced the citizens to dye their hair black, and bathe in dye to darken their skin.
Typically fused out for a pre-unification outland settlement. If nothing else, the program of unification put most of those deranged despots out of work.
I suppose that's one thing it was good for. Historical records say that Akhenaten was killed, and his daughter Nephron took over as ruler of the city.
So they traded one baron for another, then?
In this case, I believe the term pharaoh would be more appropriate.
Whatever. If this city was fairly close to the redoubt, who's to say that they didn't strip it of anything useful a century ago?
I can't answer that. We have to do the recon. I'm sure that you'd rather go there than back into Area 51.
Sounds like a long shot at best.
True. And we'd need Quavel's technical expertise, so taking her with us might present another problem. The interphaser isn't finished, so we have no choice but to use the Mattrans to get there.
After 100 years, I wouldn't get my hopes up about finding much.
Kane crossed the room to a glass-fronted gun case. He opened its door and placed the Sin-Eater on a hook.
To be honest, I don't. There's always a chance something valuable was overlooked. But let's discuss the pros and cons with Lakesh and anybody else who should be included on the expedition.
Might as well get this little expedition organized, then. But I don't expect Grant back until sometime tomorrow morning.
Page me when he gates in. I just hope he's not too tired to make another jump.
Even if he is, he wouldn't mention it. His image, you know.
The next day, shortly before noon, Kane and Grant entered the redoubt's large cafeteria, where most of the briefings were convened. Brigid sat at a corner table, talking quietly to Lakesh. Reba Dufour was seated opposite the two, her attention fixed on several sheets of paper. Quavel sat beside her. Kane's eyes locked briefly with the inhumanly large, crystal-blue eyes of Quavel. She tilted her head slightly in greeting, as she shifted in her chair, trying to find a comfortable position. Her tiny form was encased in a silvery-gray skin-tight bodysuit. It only accentuated the distended condition of her belly and the slenderness of her limbs. The material of the one-piece garment was a synthetic polymer with a high degree of elasticity, and it provided adequate support. The two men took seats on either side of Lakesh and Brigid. As he sat, Kane reached out and grabbed a cup from a nearby table and filled it with coffee from a pot at his elbow.
So, we've come up with a plan?
Yes, friend Kane. The good doctor has been providing us with a laundry list of everything to look for at your destination.
Mohandas Lakesh Singh was a man of medium height, with thick, glossy black hair, a dark olive complexion, and a long, aquiline nose. He looked no older than 45, despite a few strands of gray at his temples. Kane still felt more than a little disconcerted every time he looked at him, seeing a man who physically didn't look more than 15 years his senior, but who was, in reality, just a year or so shy of celebrating his 250th birthday. The change in Lakesh's appearance had taken place several months earlier, his youth and vigor miraculously restored by Sam, the Imperator.
My destination? I'm not going alone, am I?
Grant leaned back in his chair and crossed his arms over his chest. He scowled.
Until we know more about the destination in question, it's a little premature to say anybody is going. What is this place?
The installation was attached to Over Project Excalibur, specifically Mission Invictus. The head researcher for the mission was Dr. Connaught O'Brien. You may recall me speaking of her.
Kane and Grant nodded. Everyone at the table knew Over Project Excalibur and its many subdivisions attempted to create life forms that would survive in a world laid waste by nuclear war. They had been responsible for the first generation of scalies, stickies, swampies, and other muties that had ranged over the country in the late 21st century.
The mandate of Mission Invictus was to create the missing link, the biological bridge between pre-dark and post-dark man, a superhuman designed to thrive in the world created by the Atomic Armageddon. Our database has several extensive files pertaining to the genetic engineering work she conducted in the Guadalupe Redoubt, at least up until the time of Skydark.
Dr. O'Brien didn't achieve the objective of her mission until after the nuke cost. A staff of 12 was settled in the installation out in the Guadalupe Desert. Dr. O'Brien developed a synthetic mutagen for Phase 3 of the mission, and the man known as Akhenaten was the end result of her work. He grew to be a powerful telepath and possessed several different psionic abilities. He had been obsessed with ancient Egypt from the time he was a child. He took his name from a rather radical pharaoh who reigned during the 18th dynasty.
So this mutie from a test tube built an Egyptian city out in the middle of the barrens?
I was getting to that. Apparently, the city was already in place. It was built during the 1920s as a movie set for the silent version of the Ten Commandments, directed by Cecil B. DeMille.
A ready-made ville? Just waiting for someone to come in and take it over?
Why not? With a little creative thinking and some technical expertise, it wouldn't take much effort to tap into the water tables beneath the desert and set up hydroponics. With the information stored in the Redoubt's database, they had half the work done for them before they even started.
I don't recall seeing any mention of a city or even a tar paper outland settlement in any of the Mag Patrol reports coming out of Snakefish.
There isn't any way in hell that a city like that would go undetected, even in the Barrens. Kane and I have been on enough extended outland patrols to know that every settlement is investigated, a census taken, and depending on which ville's jurisdiction the settlement falls under, which baron ends up controlling the resources, if there are any.
Exactly. And since there is no record of any settlement in the Barrens, I'd say the place is long gone.
Quivel's large eyes focused on Kane, pinning him to his seat with her stare.
It is possible that the city does still exist. If the ruler did indeed possess powerful psionic abilities, it's not unreasonable to assume that they could have been passed down to his offspring. The descendants could have encountered magistrates before and mind-wiped the encounter, leaving no memory of what had transpired.
DeFore's face flushed a deep red.
We're engaging in a lot of pointless speculation here. It's the redoubt we should be concerned about, not if a city is still there or not. This is all hypothesizing based on anecdotal data that's 100 years old.
Very true. However, we receive a live transit line signature, so the gateway in the installation is still functioning. The question now is who will be on the jump team.
I should go.
DeFore, you don't have any experience.
I can determine if any of the medical equipment is still intact. That way we can make a preliminary list for Quivel to go over when we get back. I have to agree with you, Reba. You, Grant, and Kane should make the first jump, and when you get back, we'll go over the report and then decide what to do next.
You usually insist on joining these field trips, Baptiste.
It's just a simple scout out, right? Besides, I'm busy rebuilding the interphaser, remember?
Yeah, just a simple scout out.
Kane briefly wondered how Bridget would react if he suggested Philboyd accompany them on the trip, but decided not to press the issue. It annoyed him that she seemed to prefer the company of the lanky, myopic astrophysicist to his, at least lately. He didn't understand what she found so appealing in him, even if she was drawn to his intellect.
All right. This sounds like a plan to me, Baptiste. When do we want to leave?
The sooner the better. Let's gear up and meet in the Matt Trans chamber in 30.
Precisely 29 minutes later, Kane and Grant stood outside the brown-tinted armaglass walls of the jump chamber. Both men wore midnight-colored shadow suits that had become standard equipment for their many ventures. Although the black skin-tight garments didn't appear as if they would offer protection from flea bites, they were impervious to most wavelengths of radiation, bulletproof, and offered a good amount of protection from blunt trauma. DeFore joined them, dressed in a pair of khakis, high-topped jump boots, and a long-sleeved blouse. Normally, the woman shied away from firearms, but strapped to her waist was an old-fashioned 9mm 1914 Browning handgun. Her rucksack contained a medical kit, several packets of MREs, a laptop, and a small vid camera. Grant's and Kane's sin-eaters were strapped securely to their right forearms. Kane secured a small motion tracker to his left wrist and turned it on, watching the tiny LCD screen beep as people moved about the control chamber. Satisfied that it was working properly, he switched it off and gave the strap one last tug.
Ready to go?
As ready as I'll ever be.
Kane glanced out the door leading to the operations center and gave Bry the thumbs-up gesture. Bry, seated at the master control board, nodded in acknowledgement, and his fingers flew over the keyboard, inputting the coordinates of the destination gateway.
Transmission code's locked in, so whenever you're ready.
Kane lifted the wedge-shaped handle of the jump chamber, and the heavy door opened easily on counterbalanced pivots. Entering the chamber, he took up a position leaning against the wall opposite the doorway and tried to relax. Grant entered, his face a stony mask, but Kane knew that his partner was filled with trepidation. Kane could sympathize with him, as he also disliked using the chambers, but without access to an interphaser, the gateway was their fastest form of travel. Dufour sat between the two men on the metal hexagonal floor plates, nervously dry-washing her hands.
You sure you're good to go?
Dufour managed to force a grin.
As much as you are, Grant.
Grant pulled the door shut, the solenoids clicking soundly in place and initiating the automatic jump sequence. As tendrils of mist began to curl up from the chamber floor, Kane closed his eyes, waiting not only for the transition to begin, but also for Grant's Mat-Trans mantra.
I hate these fucking things.
Kane squeezed his eyes shut against the harsh light. He placed his hands against his temples, fearing for a moment the sudden surge of pain within his skull would blow his head apart. Within seconds, the agony receded. He had to admit that he had been through far worse when making other Mat-Trans jumps. He was lying flat on his back, which wasn't unusual. One of the enduring mysteries of the gateway process was how a jumper could begin a transition standing up, but almost always ended it lying down. Forcing his eyes open, he looked around. The armor glass walls of the gateway were a pale rust color, which was fairly easy on the eyes compared to some of the more garish color codes he had seen. Flexing his wrist tendons, he let his Sin Eater slap into his waiting palm and slowly climbed to his feet. Both Dufour and Grant were starting to stir. The big man opened his dark eyes and gazed at Kane accusingly, then closed them.
I'm getting too old for this shit.
How do you feel?
Like I always feel after a jump. Like shit. Hurt all over.
Well, maybe you shouldn't have wrestled with that Dinocephalian. How are you doing, Dufour?
The bronze-skinned buxom woman didn't attempt to stand. She lay motionless on the floor of the gateway.
Give me a minute.
Unleathering his own Sin Eater, Grant took a position on the right side of the door. He and Kane waited patiently for Dufour to regain her equilibrium. Both men were used to the side effects of the hyperdimensional jumps and recovered quickly. Dufour had only traveled by the Mat-Trans a handful of times and hadn't grown accustomed to having her molecules transformed into digital data and sent hurtling through the quantum stream. After a moment, Dufour carefully stood. She nodded curtly to both men.
Okay, I'm ready.
I'll take point.
Kane reached for the handle on the door and lifted it up. The heavy door swung open smoothly and silently, revealing a small anteroom. As with all the redoubts they had been in, the chamber led into a room containing a number of computers and monitor screens. Past the electronic equipment, Kane saw a narrow corridor. Fluorescent light strips glowed feebly from narrow channels recessed into the ceiling. Stepping down from the platform, he moved out of the anteroom and across the computer room and glanced into the hallway. Strange markings were painted on both walls of the corridor. It took Kane a moment to realize that they were hieroglyphs. He had no idea of their meaning, but from what Bridget had told them during the briefing, he was positive that they were in the right place. Grant and Dufour joined him at the entrance to the corridor. Holding up his wrist, Kane looked at the tiny LCD of the motion tracker. The small device registered nothing moving ahead of them. He knew from unpleasant experience that a lack of motion didn't mean the redoubt was uninhabited, so Kane proceeded down the passageway with extreme caution. The corridor ended at a partly ajar door, which Kane gently pushed open with a foot. Nothing jumped out at him as the door opened fully. He saw a very small, unfurnished room. The opposite wall was perforated by a metal-sheathed desk surrounded by three concentric collars of steel. Affixed to the wall beside it was a keypad. A square plastic sign beneath the keypad warned in bright red letters, "Biohazard beyond this point. Entry forbidden to personnel not wearing anti-contaminant clothing." Kane bit back a curse, looked behind him, and nodded for DeFore and Grant to join him. Grant entered first, followed by DeFore. She looked at the warning on the wall.
"This facility must have dealt with some serious pathogens during its researches."
Kane threw a questioning glance at his partner, raising his eyebrows slightly. Grant shrugged and stepped back, pulling Reba DeFore with him. Kane punched the enter button on the keypad and a green light flashed. With a rumble and a squeak of hydraulics, the metal disc rolled to the left. The room beyond was dimly lit by weak and wavering overhead lights, but Kane could make out the outlines of trestle tables. The motion tracker on his wrist remained silent as he stepped into the chamber, his eyes adjusting to the dimness around him. Lights blinked on overhead, pushing back the dimness and revealing the room's contents. Heavy tables lined the walls. A heavy pane of transparent armorglass comprised the right-hand wall, which ran the entire length of the chamber. Directly across from Kane was a twin of the door that they had just passed through. He could also see the outlines of where equipment had once taken up floor space, but nothing remained of it, not even a shard of broken glass.
"Looks like this place was cleaned out, probably a long, long time ago."
DeFore entered the chamber and looked around.
"We still have the rest of the redoubt to explore."
Kane crossed the room and punched the enter key on the pad next to the round hatch, and as with the other, it blinked green. The heavy slab of metal rolled aside. Beyond it stretched another corridor, with doorways on either side. The main sector at the end was a massive portal of vanadium steel. Kane moved quickly and silently down the corridor, pausing only briefly to peer into each doorway as he passed. Several of the rooms clearly were sleeping chambers, while another was a combination of galley and kitchen. Another contained bathing facilities, and two more were apparently storage closets. When he reached the end of the corridor, he swept the motion detector around one last time. It registered no movement.
"All clear."
The big man ignored the rooms as he walked past them to join Kane. DeFore, on the other hand, stopped at the first of the storerooms and paused at the threshold, looking apprehensively into it.
"This place is bare."
"Yeah, that's what cleaned out generally means.
As long as we're here, let's make sure."
They split up and began to inspect the small redoubt. Unlike many Totality Concept-related installations, this one wasn't a multi-leveled labyrinth of corridors and control rooms. It was stripped down and spartan. There were a total of 18 beds divided up between three dormitories, which indicated the maximum personnel of the place. The bathroom was small, but held five toilet stalls and three urinals. Three shower heads projected from a tiled wall in an enclosure, and there was a 6.5-foot-tall, bullet-shaped cylinder located in one corner. Kane recognized it as a medisterile chamber, a decontamination unit used in the mag divisions to clean up magistrates who might have strayed too near a hell zone or hotspot during a field op. Kane searched an office suite that held six desks enclosed by partitions, each one equipped with a computer terminal. None of the machines were powered up, and he wasn't sure if they could be. Two gray metal filing cabinets stood against one wall. Curiosity got the better of Kane, and he opened the top drawer of a cabinet and lifted out a file folder. Thumbing through the files contained in the folder, he saw most of them were written in scientific terminology that he found all but impossible to understand. His mind flashed to Bridget, thinking that if she were with them, it would take the woman only a glance to decipher the meaning of the file in his hands. He tamped down a surge of irrational anger that she had chosen to remain in Cerberus and tinker with one of Lockish's toys instead of joining the team. At least he hoped she was tinkering with only a toy. DeFore entered and broke his paranoid train of thought.
"What are you reading?"
Kane passed the folder to her.
"Not really reading. I can't make head or tails of it."
DeFore flipped through the sheaves of paper and then dropped the folder back into the filing cabinet.
Nothing of real importance in that. The redoubt was cleaned out quite some time ago. All the medicine, medical equipment, and laboratory equipment is missing. There are signs that the place has been visited in the past few years, though."
"Probably a mag force when they checked out all the redoubts a couple of years ago, searching for us."
"That's what I figured, too. Until this.
Reaching into a back pocket of her khakis, DeFore produced a small square box of transparent plastic containing a number of CD jewel cases. DeFore placed the box on a desk and opened it, pulling out one of the discs and turning it over in her fingers. As she flipped it, Kane noticed a red triangle with three vertical lines bisecting it. He recognized the symbol of Overproject Excalibur, which had later been adopted as the insignia of the Archon Directorate. Imprinted below the image, he saw a series of numbers. They read 1-18-08.
Is that some kind of journal or log?
I'd have to guess that's the case. They're all dated.
Maybe we can learn something from the information. They might contain the locations of other medical redoubts that could have the same kind of equipment that we need.
At the very least, they'll make for interesting additions to the Cerberus database.
Grant strode into the room, scowling as always.
Nothing of use here. Might as well jump back home.
Kane pushed himself away from the cabinet.
I want to have a look around outside first.
Why?
Curiosity, mainly. If a mag force was responsible for clearing the place out, we'll probably find some evidence outside.
What mag division would have done it?
My guess is Cobaltville.
That's right. Baron Cobalt was already making incursions into Snakefish territory.
Then he might have sent out teams to retrieve any equipment that would have been even remotely of use to him in Area 51. And since this place was used for genetic engineering, it makes a certain amount of sense.
Kane and Grant left the office and walked to the huge vanadium steel door. Grant stood by the green lever on the steel frame and pushed it up. Kane trained his Sin Eater on the rectangle of alloy as the complicated system of gears and pulleys began raising it. DeFore stood a few feet behind him. A wave of brilliant sunlight poured into the redoubt, almost blinding the three people. Shading their eyes, they squinted out at the desert wasteland that stretched out before them as far as their eyes could see. The drifting dunes of saffron and ochre seemed endless. Kane waited for several seconds, letting his eyes adjust to the harsh glare reflecting off the dunes. The heat against his face felt like it radiated from an open oven, and sweat formed on his brow. He stepped out of the interior of the redoubt and stood beneath an overhang, examining the terrain. Grant joined him, but DeFore stayed just inside the door. Neither man said a word as they took dark-lensed glasses from the pouches at the small of their backs. They walked a dozen or so paces forward, then turned around to study the exterior of the redoubt. It was a gray half-dome, nearly buried on all sides by high drifts of sand. Grant crouched, running his fingers over the sifting sands. He glanced up at Kane.
Tracks.
Kane squinted down to where Grant pointed. Two narrow, parallel grooves showed faintly against the desert hardpan beneath a layer of sand.
A wagon or a cart of some kind?
Of some kind. I suppose we could try and follow the tracks, see where they lead. They may take us to the medical equipment.
Kane stared out over the desolate landscape.
That seems like a hell of a long shot to me.
Me too. Roamers probably made the tracks. We might as well return to Cerberus and make secondary plans.
As they turned to re-enter the redoubt, Kane thought he saw sunlight glinting off metal to the north of their position. He roughly pushed DeFore further into the redoubt.
Inside.
The medic obeyed instantly, even though the narrow-eyed glance she cast over her shoulder showed she was a little irked at the rough treatment. Sin Eater in hand, Grant moved to the right of Kane. Stealthily, Kane crept toward the glitter. Light flashed from the crest of a dune, no more than 25 yards away. Keeping to a crouch, Kane scaled the face of the dune and found a half-buried glass bottle, sunlight reflecting from its surface. He released his breath and pulled the wind-scoured bottle from the sand.
Just some litter!
What kind?
Kane held the bottle over his head.
Son of a bitch!
Motherfucker!
Instinctively, Kane threw himself off the dune. Grant rushed over, eyes and gun barrel questing for a target.
That was a fucking Sin Eater!
Spitting out grit and knuckling sand from his eyes, Kane rose swiftly to his feet.
You think?
Together, the two men backed away from the dune toward the open entrance to the redoubt. A swift glance showed him DeFore just inside the doorway, her autoblaster in hand.
I don't see anybody.
Let everybody know they've got the drop on us, why don't you? Get to the gate room and stand by!
The medic hesitated a moment, then turned on her heel and ran into the darkness of the passageway.
What the hell could Mags be doing out here?
Probably not Mags. Some roamers who stole a Sin Eater, more than likely.
At that instant, a lone figure appeared on the crest of the dune. He wore ebony magistrate armor and brandished a Sin Eater. Both Kane and Grant tracked the armored figure with their pistols as it stopped and stared down at the pair.
He doesn't look much like a roamer to me.
Ooh, you think? Whoever he is, it's best if we get the first shots in, then get back to the Matrance and gate the fuck out of here.
About a dozen men appeared atop the dune and spread out in a line on either side of the magistrate.
I don't think we'll make it.
All of the men were similar in physique and clothing. Naked, except for loosely woven white linen kilts threaded through with gold wire, they were very dark-skinned, the breadth of their chest and shoulders enormous. Glittering collars of hammered gold enclosed the bases of their muscular necks. Only their heads differentiated them from one another. Each man wore jeweled, helmet-like headpieces that completely covered their faces and rested on their broad shoulders. They all followed a different design, fashioned after the appearances of an animal. Grant and Kane saw ones that depicted falcons, cats, jackals, bulls, snakes, and even a bug. Neither man saw anything that resembled a traditional blaster among the group assembled atop the dune, but all of them held long, slender silver rods tipped by V-shaped prongs.
One mag, one Sin Eater, and a bunch of fused-out sec men with fishing poles. I think we can make it.
Kane didn't immediately agree with Grant's assessment. The silver rods reminded him too much of the infrasound wands used by the hybrids. For several tense seconds, the two groups stared at each other, neither side moving or speaking. Then the magistrate stepped forward.
Don't let the armor fool you. I'm like you.
As the mag descended the face of the dune, his booted feet started miniature avalanches of sand. Kane noted he had a slight limp favoring his left leg. Although the black polycarbonate exoskeleton was standard magistrate issue, the red badge was missing from the left pectoral. Kane walked forward to meet him. Grant maintained his position, his eyes and gun never straying from the dozen figures arrayed on the crest of the dune.
What did you mean that you're like us?
The magistrate lowered his weapon and responded to Kane's question with one of his own.
What are you doing here?
That's really none of your business.
That's where you're mistaken. This redoubt and everything inside are in my jurisdiction. You're trespassing, and unless you have a damn good reason for being here, I might have to consider this a hostile incursion.
I might consider somebody shooting a bottle out of my hand the same thing. Or was that just the way you say hello in these parts?
I'm waiting.
Officious little son of a bitch, aren't you?
Kane smiled as he stared into the tinted visor of the magistrate's helmet. He couldn't make out the man's eyes, but he could tell by the rounded softness of his chin and relatively unlined face the mag was very young, probably not even 20. Kane tired of the eye-wrestling contest and lowered his weapon.
All right. We wanted to check out the equipment that might have been stored inside the redoubt.
Why?
To help a friend.
A friend?
The magistrate made something of a show of holstering his Sin Eater. Reaching up, he removed his helmet. The man was even younger than Kane had imagined, probably 18 at the most.
From what I hear, you and Grant don't have a whole lot of friends.
Where did you hear that?
Ragnarville. Then I was stationed at the Archuleta Mesa, right after I graduated the academy. That was where I stayed until you two destroyed the place.
Kane didn't bother to argue the point. Although he and Grant were directly responsible for the destruction of the facility, the act had been inadvertent. He still felt guilty about it, remembering how his and Grant's actions had caused the deaths of almost 2,000 newborn and toddler-aged hybrids.
So, you know who we are. That's not much of a surprise. But why are you here? This is a hell of a long way from either the Mesa or Area 51.
Area 51? What's that? I've never heard of the place.
Never mind. You know who we are, but who are you?
Name's Descartes.
He gestured over his shoulder at the men standing silently on the crest of the dune.
And those men are incarnates, the Guardians of Aten.
The city still exists?
Yes. I've been there for about a year now, ever since I was forced to turn my back on the magistrates and run for my life. That's why I said we were the same.
What or who forced you to do that?
Two barons were on an inspection tour of the facility, and I overheard something they said. I was found out. A senior mag named Crow tried to issue my termination warrant.
Kane nodded, fully understanding what the young man was telling him.
So you fought back?
Yeah, I did. I grabbed what supplies I could and made a run for it. If it weren't for the oracles of Aten, I would have died in the desert. But they found me and nursed me back to health.
Lucky you.
That brings us to the big question. What made you think there was anything in the redoubt?
We have our sources, as I'm sure you've heard.
How'd you even know there was a redoubt out here?
Once again, we have our sources, but there's nothing in there now.
What do you need it for?
As we said, to help a friend.
Who?
Does it make any difference?
It might. If you tell me what kind of equipment you need, I might be able to work out some sort of arrangement.
So the stuff we need has been removed to Aten?
I never said that. I said that if you told me what you need it for and who you need it for, then I could possibly help you.
Who would you be working out this arrangement with?
Hand me a name, and I'll hand you one back.
Kane turned his back on Descartes and stalked toward the redoubt.
Forget it, boy. It's too damn hot to stand around playing guessing games with you.
Give my regards to Quavel.
Astonishment leapfrogged over shock in the pit of Kane's belly. He stopped in mid-step, but he did not turn.
What did you say?
You heard me, Kane.
For once, the scowl on Grant's face lifted, replaced by a mask of surprise. Eyes narrowing to angry, suspicious slits, Kane spun on his heel and glared at the younger man.
Where did you hear that name, boy? The Mesa?
Descartes met Kane's aggression with a calm demeanor.
She's who you needed the medical equipment for, isn't she?
Kane raised his sin-eater and aligned Descartes' forehead with a boar, even though he saw the incarnates pointing their strange staffs at him and Grant.
How do you know about her?
Descartes' composure faltered slightly and he swallowed hard.
I knew her in the Mesa complex, as you figured.
And how do you know she was the reason we came here? Is that the reason you and your menagerie are out here?
You'll have to come with me to learn that, Kane.
Come with you where, boy?
Descartes bristled slightly at being addressed as boy again.
Aten, where else? You can talk to Queen Nephron and learn everything you need to know.
Forget that. We're not stoops.
Descartes shrugged as if the matter were of little importance to him.
It's your choice. I give you my word as a former magistrate that you won't be harmed if you come with us. You could negotiate with Queen Nephron for the equipment that Quavel needs, if we have it, and more besides.
The reference to a Queen Nephron didn't soothe Kane's apprehension. He remembered Brigid noting that a Nephron had taken power in Aten over 100 years ago. The likelihood that the two Nephrons were one and the same didn't seem high, but he and Grant had encountered astoundingly long-lived entities before.
I don't think so. At least not under these circumstances. Maybe later I can return.
A one-time-only invitation, Kane. I'm breaking the law as it is. But since you and Grant are something special...
Thanks.
Kane gave the group of incarnates one last look before he turned back toward the redoubt.
Well, it's been pointless knowing you.
He wondered if Descartes was experienced enough to recognize a bluff, or the deliberate show of disdain by keeping his back to him and his incarnates. Kane and Grant had crossed less than half the distance to the entrance when Defoe came running out of the doorway, her face registering excitement and fear.
The gateway's been activated. We got inbound jumpers.
Grant and Kane rocked to a halt.
Could it be someone from Cerberus?
Not unless a hell of an emergency blew up in the last couple of hours since we've been gone. I didn't stick around to see who was coming through.
Who the hell is that?
Grant turned at the sound of the young man's approach.
Reba Defoe, our medical expert.
And what's the problem?
Your redoubt has an unauthorized jumper.